This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava. Writer, poet, playwright, and human rights activist Ariel Dorfman survived what he considers the first September 11th. On that date in 1973, Chilean President Salvador Allende was overthrown in a violent coup that put Augusto Pinochet in power. Ariel Dorfman was on President Allende's staff, and by a twist of fate, he was home while many of his colleagues and his president were killed. Ariel Dorfman's experience that day, that September 11th, and in the years later when he left Chile to live in the U.S., are collected in a new series of essays. This new book is called Other Septembers, Many Americas, Selected Provocations, 1980 to 2004. Ariel Dorfman makes his home in Durham, where he's a professor at Duke University, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And, well, you were one of the first, Ariel Dorfman, to recognize the echo, the dual significance of the date, September 11th, back in 2003.
2001, you mean?
Three years ago, next month. You were one of the first to recognize the echo of that date, September 11th, its importance to the two countries which you'd called home. Chile,
yes.
And the U.S.
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, I woke up that day in mourning, as I always do, because every September 11th, but this was particularly a day of mourning because, you know, it had been many, many years before that I had watched terror descend from the skies. I had watched a country be destroyed. I had watched and said to myself, nothing will ever be the same again. So this had happened to me. And all of a sudden, I'm watching this happen again to my second country, the land, you know, where I grew up as a child, which gave me this language which I speak now, in which I wrote many of these articles and essays that are
in English,
are collected in English. In English and in Spanish. I wrote them in both languages, in fact. You know, at times I write in English and I'm writing in Spanish, I correct one with the other. But the fact is I am entirely bilingual and bicultural and binational in some sense, which doesn't mean that I belong fully in either place. But the fact is that for me, the trauma of September 11th, 1973, when Allende is overthrown and I'm thrown into exile, is echoed, as you said. And almost immediately I write an article, both for the Guardian in London and simultaneously for the Los Angeles Times. I think it was 4 or 5 days later it came out, in which I speak about the last September 11th or the other September 11th. There it was ambiguous what that would be called. Because what I said to myself was, America or Americans, listen to me. You have now been placed in the situation that I was in, that so many have been in, and that so many are in at this very moment, which is life is precarious. Life, terror descends upon you for no reason, apparently, whatsoever. And it is a great opportunity to try to understand how we create a world where there is no September 11th in Chile. In other words, the United States does not intervene in foreign countries to destroy the democratic government of a land. And there are no terrorists, fundamentalists, Islamic fundamentalists, coming to your land to destroy you. How do we create that world? And, you know, my hope was that the United States and the American citizens would, in fact, out of the suffering that came of that moment, and out of the solidarity that the world showed to America in that moment, it would use that opportunity to look at itself lovingly and critically.
And one of the essays you have in this book, Other Septembers, Many Americas, gets to this because a year later, 2002, just after the first anniversary of the attacks in New York and Washington, you wrote an essay titled Love Letter to America. And you say that on 2001, September 11th, innocence was handed back to America. And a year later, in looking it over, you write, beware the plague of victimhood.
Yes. You know, I mean, I have lived through the situation of being a victim and being surrounded by victims. I'm not speaking only about the Chilean people, you know, and the fact that we have the desaparecido, the disappeared, and so many tortured people and so many exiled. I mean, the enormous suffering that we have undergone. But the fact that because that sensitized me in some sense to human rights violations all over the world, I have spent many, many years in the presence of people who one could be called victims. And there is, in victimhood, there is something to be learned. One learns dignity. One learns how to survive. One learns that we we may be able, in fact, not to forget, but at least to forgive those who have hurt us, to find a way to become better because we have been hurt so bad. And we do not return hatred with hatred.
But yet you write of it as being a plague of victimhood.
But it's a plague because of the following. Because when you have been hurt very badly, you automatically suppose that you are better than somebody else, that you are in some sense morally superior. It gives you sort of a plateau from which you look down and you say, oh, you haven't been hurt as much as I've been hurt. You know, in fact, that we play that game all the time. We play it in love relationships. We play it in power relationships. We play it in nation relationships. So it's simply very dangerous. Now, it's particularly dangerous to be a victim if you're very powerful, because then what you want to do is you want to get rid of being a victim. You know, what I say is, who has been the major victim of the United States in the last half century? If you want to look at it from the world point of view, it was Vietnam. Yeah, I mean, millions of Vietnamese were killed. They were killed there. They weren't killed here. The Americans went to Vietnam and killed people there for whatever reasons. I mean, I certainly think the reasons were spurious, but let's say the America was trying to defend itself from communism, whatever reason they wanted to give, the domino, which didn't exist at all because it was the other way around. Capitalism is more of a domino than communism was. But the fact is that these are the major victims that you had there, right? And I think America knows it. I think the people in the United States feel very, very bad, very ambiguous, certainly, about that conflict, which we've seen in the latest things about Kerry and Bush and the Swift Boat veterans and all that. It's a very complicated issue. So America has felt itself to have victimized these people and lost that war. And I think that what September 11th did is it said to the Americans, oh, what? We're the victims now. We've been hurt. We've been terribly damaged. Now, what are we going to do about it? Now, the result has been, I think, disastrous. In other words, the result has been, okay, let's show them what you do when you hurt somebody like me. In other words, if you're a giant, if you're powerful, you're colossal, if you have all this military might, how dare you do this to me? And, you swat out at people and you bomb people and you kill a lot of more people.
You take issue with the U.S. going to war in Iraq.
Certainly, yes.
How about going to war in Afghanistan?
You know,
what was your stand at that time?
Let's just say,
in terms of swatting out.
Let's just say the following, that compared with Iraq, Afghanistan was at least you could say, the people who planned that destruction of New York and Washington, who hijacked the planes, et cetera. At least they were trained there, they were there, and they're certainly, let's just say there's a reasonable motive for going there. I think it's the wrong thing to do because I think that there were other ways and better ways of isolating that and of isolating that man, who, by the way, of course, had been trained with American money against the Soviets. So it's a problem of backlash. But certainly, if you look at that, there was a direct cause. In other words, you're going after, supposedly going after, even if you let them go, right? I mean, basically, in Bora Bora, you know, they let Osama bin Laden and his other terrorist fanatics go. The fact is, in the case of Iraq, there was no justification whatsoever. I mean, there was really no justification. I'm not saying, by the way, and I have an essay here, a very, very strong one, about what I think of Saddam Hussein. In other words, over and over again, I have opposed Saddam Hussein. I opposed him at the times when Donald Rumsfeld was cozying up to him in Baghdad. So I've been against tyrants everywhere.
On the grounds of his human rights violations.
Well, on the grounds of human rights violations, on the grounds that he's a warmonger, on the grounds that he invaded another country, you know? But I think, you know, war, when you say war is the last resort, what I mean by that is you have to fight, struggle, do everything you can to try to make sure that you do not go to war. That doesn't mean that there may not be times when that's necessary. I don't think that that was the case. And was I think that deep in the American psyche, there was a need to erase what had happened. Say, bring us back. Let's put the world back the way it used to be. So, I mean, I wrote a letter to an unknown Iraqi dissident.
To an unknown Iraqi dissident.
Right, because yeah. I said, who are you? I don't know who you are, faceless. And I understand why you want Saddam Hussein. Now, this is just before the war began. I understand why you want the war finished, why you want Saddam Hussein, why you want people to invade, why you want liberation. Of course, who wouldn't want liberation from a fiend, from a monster, from a corrupt leader such as Saddam Hussein, from a tyrant? But I was saying, I have to disagree with the American invasion as a way of giving you liberation, because in fact it's going to bring more devastation, more pain. The way to do this is for you yourselves to get rid of this dictator. If you get rid of the dictator, then it's your problem. And the result will be, with the help of the people of the world, it will be much, much better than if there's an invasion. And I really believe that if people read what I wrote just before the invasion, they will find nothing wrong with what I said then. I was totally prophetic about everything that was going to happen.
I wonder if this presents a conundrum, though, that when it said that you have to figure your problem out yourself as a country. I mean, that could be decades longer that people live under the kind of repression that, say, Chileans lived under a Pinochet, without anybody coming in from the outside to help oust the dictator. I just wonder if your view is it's up to each country to decide.
Well,
then,
you know, there are limits in that sense. For instance, I was, in spite of many of my friends on the left disagree with me on this, but I was in favor of the intervention in relation to the Albanian,
the Kosovo,
mm-hmm. Kosovo. And I thought that East Timor, you needed that. In other words, if there is an ongoing genocide that you can stop, in other words, that you can save a million lives, I think the international community as such needs to intervene. So I'm not against intervention of all sorts. I just think that one has to be very judicious about how you use it. Make sure the international community is behind it. Be sure there's genocide going on. So that when Saddam Hussein is gassing the Kurds, that's when you intervene. Not when, in fact, he's debilitated by all these sanctions for 10 years.
We are talking today with Ariel Dorfman, writer, playwright, and professor at Duke University. His new book is a collection of essays called Other Septembers, Many Americas. If you'd like to join the conversation and have a question for Ariel Dorfman, our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava. We're talking today with writer, playwright, and human rights activist Ariel Dorfman, who now lives in Durham. He spent much of his childhood and young adulthood in Chile after living for a number of years in the U.S., but then he left Chile after the overthrow of President Salvador Allende on September 11th, 1973. Ariel Dorfman has written about his memories of that day, among other recollections, in his latest book. It is a collection of essays called Other Septembers, Many Americas. Selected Provocations, 1980 to 2004. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a question or comment about September 11th, that anniversary for the U.S. September 11th of 3 years ago is coming up. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. Well, Ariel Dorfman, this new book is a collection of essays you've written since 1980 to the present. And many of them are an attempt to understand U.S. culture and your feelings about it. And we should explain some of your history. You have been in exile just about in one form or another
all
your
life.
Your parents came to the U.S. from Argentina.
Right. I was 2 and a half then. I acquired English, and I became an all-American kid. In other words, I loved Mickey Mantle, and I didn't like the Dodgers. And
you grew up in Queens, right?
I grew up in Queens, So, I mean, I listened to Ozzy and Harriet and Maggie and Jigs. This was my country, and it still is my country in many ways.
But you left this country
because McCarthy was persecuting my father, who was very left-wing, and he was in the UN. He went to Chile. I fell in love with Chile, fell in love with my wonderful wife, Angelica, and I became very enamored of the idea of a revolution that would be a peaceful democratic revolution, which was the case of Salvador Allende. And then when that fell, when the government fell, I came to the States. I mean, really, I wandered around Europe, and then I came to the States. So my perspective is a rather special one for an Americano. I'm an American, and I'm Americano, a Latin American, an American, a North American, a South American. I'm in a place. People like to speak about being on the border. I'm on the border. I'm sort of looking at one side with the eyes. I look at the United States with the eyes of Latin America. And then in this book, I also have several essays on Latin America. But I look at it from the perspective loaned to me by William Faulkner and Emily Dickinson and Louis Armstrong. There's talk about that. So in a sense, I'm inside and outside all the time. And this allows me, I think, a view of the United States which is very gentle in one sense and very angry with it at the same time, because I don't think it lives up very often to all its promise, all that it could do. It could be a force for such good, you know, and I'm not saying it's a force necessarily for evil, but it certainly, I mean, I don't get the idea that they're evildoers or things like that. I just think, you know, that it does not, America does not often allow its power to go in the absolutely right direction, which it could. And I think September 11th, 2001 was an example of that. But these essays, you know, these articles are very much a look, because they're not only a look at the last two or three years. I look at phenomena such as E.T., the extraterrestrial, and I say, well, isn't he an alien? What does that mean? Do you have to Americanize the world? Because he's an Americanized little puppet in some sense. What would happen if he had fallen in Uganda or in the middle of South Africa?
What would
Soweto?
Have happened if he fell there?
Well, there wouldn't have been a Spielberg film, you know, in the sense that it can only be a film about this child, this alien. Mm. So I speak about the Americanization of the world in a sense, right? Mm. I speak about Uncle Scrooge McDuck and the relationship with Horatio Alger and the success story of America. I speak of video games. What I mean is I'm looking at the deeper roots of the American psyche, of what makes this country tick in some sense. And I look at it as an alien myself, a legal alien, let's say. Mm. But, you know, where we're all transgressive, those who come from outside are transgressive in the sense that we look in ways that are not typical of, you know, I mean, when I see a garage sale, I say, wow, Americans have such problems with community that they have to show off their wares. They have to exhibit the letters of their grandparents. We would never do that in Latin America, you know? I mean, so I'm always looking at it. And then I look at Latin Americans and I say, wow, this is not the way things would be in the States. So I'm sort of going back and forth, and I love that about the book, and I love that about my capacity for doing that.
Yeah. There is that tone throughout that you're describing here, and it struck me in an essay that I thought I had read before, and it's in the book called Cold Waters.
Cold Waters, yes.
In which you talk about going, you're in Chile, you're a young man now, and you're sort of rejecting all those things from America.
I don't want anything to do with America.
Not even speaking English. And
yeah,
there's
exactly.
A little boy, an American boy at a hotel pool who is obnoxious.
He's very obnoxious. He's a little American kid, you know, one of these little brats, really. And this is a moment when I wrote this for Granta for their series called What We Think About America, you know. And I remember that this kid was so obnoxious, you know, and I wanted nothing to do with the United States. All of a sudden, the kid and his mother didn't care at all. So I was sort of extrapolating that, saying, okay, here are the Americans. Here they come again with their loud voices saying, here I am. Take care of me. I can do whatever
I
want.
So this two-year-old, you know, is a neo-colonialist, right?
Sort of. Okay, I mean, but, you know, for my lefty perspective of the 60s, here was this kid, like I had been. In a sense, I was sort of hating him because I hated myself, you know. And the mother was there soaking up the sun, couldn't care less. You know, too bad you Chileans don't like what my son does. Too bad. Get yourself a country. You know, that sort of attitude. And all of a sudden, the kid falls in the pool. He falls in the pool and begins to drown. And I hesitate for perhaps a second or 2 seconds. I swear I do this, and I can't stand the fact that I did that. But one thing that a writer's got to do is got to tell the truth about what he or she, you know, has lived. And I did it. I hesitated. I hesitated in the sense of saying, you know what, serves you right. Why am I supposed to fish you out? You know, did you fish us out? Or have you just come to take our copper away, our iron away, our fish away? Did you, you know, in the 1840s, you came and your drunken sailors killed our people here?
And so all of this is going through your mind in a couple of
seconds. I'm not
saying
that. Yeah, I'm just saying, you know, that doesn't go through my mind. Mm-hmm. I'm saying it's in your cells. Mm-hmm. When you know, the United States takes away half of the Mexican territory, they don't care. I mean, that sort of thing, you know? They invade every country. They invade Nicaragua, and then they invade them again. So why should I mean, why should I be the one to fish this kid out? 2 seconds later, I jumped in the pool, you know. Thank the Lord that I did that. You know, I don't or thank whatever goodness is in humanity that I did that. But I did hesitate. And it's the coldness in me that hesitated, you know. And I use that episode. I build upon that episode to say to myself how we can be. And then I say, worst of all, is I bring, of course, this child to the sputtering child to the mother. And then I find out that the mother had been at a concert for Louis Armstrong where I had strutted. And so there I was, you know, it's I love the American culture. And at the same time, you know, I don't like what America does is its foreign policy. And this tremendous contradiction still lives in me and lives in the whole world. There was, you know, a lot of people live the same contradiction. And I try to analyze anti-Americanism as knee-jerk in some cases. And yet, at the same time, there is forms of anti-Americanism which comes not from really this knee-jerk reaction, but comes from very deep things that America does do to the world. And it does it almost as if not realizing it. I mean, they say, why do they hate us, you know? Well, the fact is, maybe there are certain things in the past of America that makes people hate them. I don't think hatred is the answer. I don't think it's the answer, no matter what's been done to you, you know? And I have reason to, I mean, Chileans have reasons to hate America, and yet they don't. They didn't come here. By the way, they did not come here to kill anybody. They didn't come to do a terrorist attack, right? Just because we were terrorized by what the United States did in our country. On the contrary, you know? So there's a whole, you could almost say that these essays or these meditations are ways in which I'm trying to deal with anger and trying to find ways in which persuasion, the gentle persuasion of words, works. And there's a whole section of this book,
but not
which
in
is
a
about
numbing,
art.
But not in, the idea of words is not to be in a numbing way, but to point out that there are these things that happen. There are these realities. But as you wrote at one point, it's comfortable to employ anti-Americanism as a way of avoiding the faults and deficiencies
Absolutely.
Of our own societies.
Absolutely. Just like it's easy to be anti-Islam, to forget your own problems as well, saying, oh, it's their problems. They're the ones. They're the guilty ones. If we just get rid of the evildoers, then it'll all be fine. You know, there's always this problem of intelligence. We're speaking about having better intelligence in Iraq and therefore torturing people to get it, or having better intelligence about weapons of mass destruction where there was no intelligence whatsoever, you know. But, you know, I'm for another sort of intelligence. I'm for thinking intelligence, which is you think about the world, you try to understand that world. If you think about the world, not think about it eternally like sort of a Hamlet, but think about it in the sense of trying to understand what makes the world the way it is and act accordingly to it, I would say, you know, I would dare to say that things will go better. Things will go better because we will have some form of understanding. And that's why, you know, as a writer, I think that we are the guardians. I just wrote this in a Los Angeles Times piece, which was yesterday, you know. We're the ultimate guardians of complexity, really, of the word. The word is as complex as looking for different sides and different issues, trying to figure things out. If we can do that, maybe we can find our way out of this very tremendous labyrinth that we find ourselves in the world today, this confusion.
Ariel Dorfman is our guest today on The State of Things. Our number is 1-877-962-9862 if you'd like to join the conversation. Nat is with us from Raleigh. Hi there, Matt. Hi, Nat.
Hey. I have a question for the professor.
Yes.
Hello.
Hey. I really admire where you stand for, and this is the first time I'm hearing you, and I really appreciate every word that you said. My question is, do you see September 11th as a product or as a result of American a long time intervening in the Middle East and in the Arab world affair? And if that's like, you know, what the, I mean, that's the result that we get after, I don't know, 50 or how many years we've been intervening in their problems, what's the solution from your point of view?
Yes, well, I mean, I don't think that September 11th can only be reduced to the fact that America intervenes in the foreign affairs of the Middle East. I think that they have had a very short-sighted policy in the Middle East in general. And of course, there are many resentful people in the Middle East who with reason, some and some with less reason, feel that America has intervened on the wrong side over and over again. I don't see an immediate solution to this. I mean, I certainly think that there are ways in which if this president had expended all the energy he's expended on invading Iraq, on trying to find a solution to the Palestinian and Israeli conflict, which is the knot that has to be untied, that has to be solved. I mean, we have to find a way of solving. We have to find a way of allowing those two peoples, both of whom I mean, the Palestinian people are now in a national liberation struggle. And, you know, the Israeli people were born of a national liberation struggle. And it's a very complicated thing when two national liberation struggles meet each other, especially when one of them has become almost a superpower and is doing unspeakable things in the West Bank and in Gaza, as some of the people who are looking for the liberation of Palestine are doing to the Israelis as well. And I reject both of those. I think that the United States could, in fact, engage in a very, very, very strong way in the Middle East. I think it would certainly help in that sense. I believe that there are ways in which I certainly think, for me, the major incredible thing is that you have now spent almost $150 billion in the war in Iraq. And if you think of what could be done in this country, just in healthcare, just in education, just in bridges built. I mean, bridges built in all senses. It's horrifying. Or what could be done to fight tuberculosis or AIDS, or to give computers to people, or to help in the liberation of women, precisely in places such as the Middle East. You know, there are so many things that could be done, which is a gentle form of intervention. It's not an intervention because you have the bombs. It's the intervention because you are able to help. You're able to show with your example these things. So, I mean, I can't turn this into sort of a foreign policy seminar or something like that. But I think that there are ways in which America can use the right way. In other words, I was just at Cooper Union, and I remembered as I was speaking there with a group of other writers, with Russell Banks, Paul Auster, Don DeLillo, Francine Prose. And that was the same place from where President Lincoln in 1860 had spoken about, speaking against slavery, said, "It is not might which makes us right, but it's the striving to be right which makes us mighty." Now, that is a very important thing for Lincoln, who was the great wordsmith of all the American presidents, to be telling us today.
If you were to hold up a mirror back over the past 3 years, where would you say the U.S. blew what it had won in sympathy from the world and blew its stature?
I think that it came when... it came in many different ways, but I think there was a tremendous failure of leadership in this country. And I don't think it's only a problem of the Republicans. I think the Democrats did not show leadership either, you know? When Susan Sontag said in The New Yorker, "We must mourn together, we don't have to be stupid together," she got hate calls, right? Joan Didion has just written a long essay in which she speaks about the fact that after September 11th, she found people everywhere buying books about Islam, beginning to talk about these things. I think it was the time to say the following. In other words, if I had been the president of this country, which is, I mean, I don't think I could be the president of anything here, you know. I mean, I don't like power myself, but I think that the discourse should have been the following. We have been attacked horribly, terribly. We are going to find these people. We are going to bring these people to justice, which means this is a criminal problem. This is a police problem. The police of the world with our police are going to find these people. We're going to bring them to justice. Now, this is a wake-up call for America. This has not happened because people are merely envious of us, or because we're so rich, or because we're so good. It's not that the evil people want to hurt us because we're good. It's because it's a very complex situation.
But is that not part of it?
It's part of it. Of course it's
part of
it.
I mean, it's not all just about the Palestinian conflict.
Of course. No. Of course it's part of it. It's part of it. I mean, if it weren't part of it, then we would be even more insane than we really are. No. The fact is that that of course the people who murder in the ways in which that murder occurred, which the terrorist murdered in New York, was a heinous crime, right? But if you separate that crime and say there was only that crime, and basically 3,000 Americans are worth much more than 3 million Vietnamese, if you say that, if that's the equation in your head, that's not how we construct a new world. We have to construct a world in which every one of the lives of a child in Milwaukee is as valuable as a child in Najaf. It's got to be like that, you know.
Do you have any sense that would ever happen among
yes, Yes, I do.
You do.
Because there was a time when slavery was natural. There was a time when you couldn't vote, Melinda. You know, you had no right to vote. And Susan B. Anthony went to jail because of that, okay? So, I mean, there was a time when children were beaten senselessly.
But
when
I wonder,
they worked.
Though,
I mean, what I mean is humanity does advance. It does create extraordinary moments.
But if you have nations, nations are always going to impart more value on their citizens than citizens elsewhere.
I mean, No. It's different to say that, of course, if an American citizen is hurt, the United States has to take care of its citizens first, right? But, you know, there's a thing called human rights. There's a thing called humanity. And, you know, I must say the following. I belong to humanity first. Then I am a Chilean. And then I am an American, okay? An American and North American. I've got no problem with that. Those are overlapping, right? But I'm not going to say you've got to torture somebody, even if they're guilty. I have a long essay here about Ivan Karamazov, you know, and what happens if the whole world is based, Dostoevsky says, upon the torture of one innocent child. And I throw back the question to Dostoevsky, what happens if the goodness of the world, the welfare of the world depends upon the torture of a guilty person? No, one does not torture anybody. So if you're saying in order to be happy, for America to be happy, you have to torture people elsewhere, I'm saying no, under no circumstances, because those are crimes against humanity. Those international laws, those are laws it's taken us thousands of years to get to, you know? There used to be a time when you went into war. There's Geneva Conventions. They're not just something you just throw out. You just vomit the Geneva Conventions. They came out of the fact that horrible things were done in the Second World War. You didn't want those things done again. You don't want your soldiers submitted to those. We don't want other soldiers submitted to that either, of any sort, no matter how heinous they may be.
We will continue our conversation with Ariel Dorfman, writer and professor at Duke University. His new book is Other September's Many Americas. We'll get to more of your calls in just a moment. The number is 1-877-962-9862. More on the discussion of Other September's, Abu Ghraib, and the rest coming up on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava. With us this hour is writer Ariel Dorfman. He's a professor at Duke University, essayist, playwright. You may be familiar with his play and the movie Death and the Maiden. His latest book is a collection of essays called Other September's Many Americas, Selected Provocations, 1980 to 2004. We're taking your calls. The number's 1-877-962-9862. And just before the break, Ariel Dorfman, you were talking about one of the essays in this book, The Final Temptation of Ivan Karamazov. It opens, this essay does, with the question, is torture ever justified? And I take this essay, having been written just this year, the latest in this collection.
We just managed to get it in fact.
And being a reflection on what happened at Abu Ghraib, the prison, with the maltreatment of prisoners there.
It was torture. It was not maltreatment.
You write there at the end, though, you ask, what if the person being endlessly tortured for our well-being is guilty?
Yes, well, that's the question. It's the question of the ticking bomb, you know? And here's the real difficulty, you know? The difficulty is if they were saying, this will save your mother, your children, your family, would you torture? I can only pray I would not. I can't swear I would not. I can only pray I would not. I could only pray that I would kill myself before hurting somebody in those ways. We have to understand that these are people who have become defenseless. They are tied in front of us when the dogs attack them, when they are stripped naked, when they are muzzled, when their eyes are blindfolded, when somebody puts electricity to their genitals, when they're put with their head inside a bucket of, I won't even mention what, you know, and they think they're going to drown, they're going to die, and many of them do. We cannot do this. Now, it is a difficult question. It's not an easy question because, of course, very often your enemies, will not resort to gentlemanly duels, you know?
If you were in
right.
the same situation.
But the fact is, you know, that war is, you know, it's you know, Americans are saying, look at these cowardly Iraqis who are in the mosques, okay? Or they don't come out and fight in the open. Yeah, but America's got, you know, got hundreds and hundreds of airplanes and thousands of tanks, and they can bomb them into nothingness. And then you're complaining because the enemy does all these things. I mean, I don't think anybody should be in a mosque, you know. I think those places are sacred. But I think that the body of each person is also sacred. I don't think you have to kill people. In other words, I think you have to do everything possible not to kill people. So, you know, Ivan Karamazov asks the question, what if the person is innocent? I ask a more difficult question, what if he or she is guilty?
But the answer you come up with ultimately is...
is no, you should never do this. Mm. Or I pray that that's the case. Now, I just want to say something about this because it's related to the book. Over and over in this book, I access literature. I go to literature. I go to art, literature, music, plastic forms of art, because I'm always looking for those spaces. First of all, that's the best thing we do as human beings, you know, besides our love for one another. It's our capacity to imagine. And I always look for those places where the imagination can create fields in which we can play, in which we can work out these problems, so that Dostoevsky, who died many, many, many years ago, still has messages for us. Martin Luther King, who died many years ago with that eloquence of his. I speak about Martin Luther King. There's an essay about him, you know, and how he was like Salvador Allende or not. I'm always looking for the ways in which we can use the language of Cervantes, use the language, and there's several book reviews that I did in the New York Times, use the language as a way of exploring our common humanity, and especially the difficult dilemmas we have as human beings.
Because it does seem you come back to that issue again and again of what you described as your own experience poolside in Chile when the boy fell in the pool.
Yes.
Is there's that cold center in all of us, but it differs in how each of us
But that cold center can be melted. Hmm. It can be melted with understanding, with intelligence, with emotion, with poetry very often. In fact, there are three poems here which are from The Other Side of Death, in which instead of excoriating Colin Powell, what I do is I ask him why he put put over Guernica of Picasso in the UN before that. Why
had
did
it covered
that?
Up?
What did he cover it up?
So it didn't show what
did
this
it up,
war
right?
scene.
And then, you know, I have the poets of Iraq asking things of a captain who decides to name things in Iraq with his own names. I'm constantly looking at the way in which poetry can change that world. So it's a wager for eloquence, for gentleness, for understanding. For a fierce understanding, let's say, right?
Yeah. You often come back to what happened in Chile 30-some-odd years ago, September 11th, 1973, when Allende was... there was a coup, and he died, and the government folded. And then that was followed by years of torture, people disappearing under Augusto Pinochet. He is in the news again, 88 years old now, and just last week, he's back in Chile, and the Supreme Court stripped him of immunity from prosecution.
Right.
What should be done in his case?
Well, in his case, I mean, if he is able to stand trial, which appears to be the case, because once again, the reason why they did this is because he shows to himself to be in perfect mental health. What needs to be done in that case is put him on trial, and I doubt that he will end up in jail or anything of the sort, you know. But he has to answer for these things. Now, if he cannot remember, if he's, you know, if he's drooling and is unable to answer a word about this, one is not going to punish the husk of his body. It's not him, you know. Once again, here I have a little essay in which before he ceased to be commander-in-chief, I sent him an open letter about the Iliad. I used the Iliad. And I said, remember the Iliad. Remember what happened at the end of the Iliad when Achilles is taking revenge upon those who have hurt him by denying the body of Hector to his people, to his father. Priam comes to Achilles and asks him for this. And that's how the Iliad ends. It ends with a banquet, with a funeral. It ends with the warriors agreeing that there are certain rules. I'm sorry, I hit this microphone in my desire to be back in Troy at that very, very extraordinary moment. We have to understand, these are the founding moments of our culture. I say to Pinochet, as I would say to President Bush, as I would say to a future President Kerry, Western civilization was born out of things like the Iliad and the Odyssey. It was born out of the idea that after the war, as the dogs of war eat at us, as the anger eats at us, as our pride takes over, yet it ends in a father coming to beg the warrior, give me back the body of my son. And the warrior, the cold center, melts. He does not throw it into the cold waters of his own devious heart, but says, yes, you will have this child. And I am, he's not sorry he killed that man, but he will not desecrate that body. This is a very important thing. In other words, once again, it took us thousands of years to reach the conclusion that one does not desecrate the bodies of one's enemy, you know? All these extraordinary, and by the way, religion is very often, not organized religion, but the great prophets of religion very often say these things. They are great moral forebearers, you know, like Martin Luther King himself was in that sense. We need to find a moral compass in the middle of it, and we need an aesthetic compass next to the moral compass. Because very often, what the aesthetics will do, what literature will do, and that's what I keep on saying in this book, is it will take us to explore the darkness that we have, the ambiguity we have, the complexity we have. I find it numbing and terrifying that somebody like George Bush could say he never made a mistake. I mean, I would never say such a thing. I mean, I could tell you thousands. In fact, my whole book is based upon my mistakes. If I didn't have any mistakes, life would be very, very boring indeed.
What do you think, just to take us up to the present in the closing moments here, the Republican convention getting started today, what's your take on that?
Well, you know...
Because the ongoing battle, at least with the advertisements in this campaign, there's not a lot of meeting of the minds between the two parties.
I think that if you're going to put Schwarzenegger there and he's going to, I think that you should have a platform which is for abortion, for choice, basically. It's not for abortion. It's for choice, for gay rights. You know, so if you're going to have all these moderates up there, why not have that be the platform of the president? It isn't. So it's another illusion, I think. And I once again, what writers do is they puncture illusions. Yeah. That doesn't mean that I don't puncture other illusions as well, because I'm certainly a radical. I wouldn't call myself necessarily a liberal. But I'm a very gentle radical in that sense. But by the way, I wanted to say, Melinda, two things. One is I'm going to be reading today at the Regulator.
Okay.
At the Regulator bookstore in Durham. So if anybody wants to come up and speak to me personally and listen to some of these essays. And the other is that they can read my essays. Four of them I'm going to put up on my website, which is www.adorfman.duke.edu. That's a little, I mean, you know. Plug. If we can spend billions on ads about whether John Kerry's a hero or not, we can spend a little time just saying
you're going to get yours,
know?
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. I just want people to read me.
Yeah. And finally, just in the last half minute we have, politics runs through your writing. Do you pay attention to the politics here in North Carolina?
Yes, I take a look at it. You know, I mean, I still don't feel myself enough to be a North Carolinian. I wish I did more. I think I need to. I'm very interested in phenomenon, particularly the phenomenon of the Latinos here in North Carolina.
Okay. Ariel Dorfman, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much, Melinda, for having me.
Ariel Dorfman's new book is Other September's Many America's Selected Provocations, 1980 to 2004. Triangle-based writer and photographer John Rosenthal never paid a lot of attention to photographs until he was 28 years old. That's when a friend of his insisted that he look through a book of photographs by Henri Cartier-Bresson. Cartier-Bresson died this summer, and John Rosenthal has this recollection.
The moment I looked at Cartier-Bresson's photographs, my life changed. And it wasn't just because I was looking at great photographs. It was the discovery of a new mode of perception, which, like poetry, combined clarity and elusiveness, but did it wordlessly, as if the simple act of paying attention could itself create significance. I was entranced. One of the photographs I looked at that day seemed, at first glance, to be about birds, for they were everywhere. Three large, white, sun-drenched birds, doves, actually, perched, not inside, but on top of a bell-shaped birdcage. The photographer must have been standing right next to them because they loomed in the right-hand corner of the image, too close to be in focus. One of these birds appeared to be looking at the photographer out of a black, regal eye. Naturally, I turned towards the more focused spaces of the photograph, and that's when I saw the man towards whom the birds seemed to incline. An odd man, I thought, with a neat white beard and mustache, wire-framed glasses, and a little stocking hat. He sat below the marble table on which the bell-shaped birdcage rested, in shadow, a little recumbent, actually, as he read a large book open on his lap. In his left hand he held a dove. Perhaps it was his favorite bird, the one most domesticated. This man was perhaps a little past middle age, a very unobtrusive figure reclining in the shadows, wearing, I suddenly notice, an overcoat, or maybe it was a bathrobe. But no, it was probably an overcoat, because he also wore a scarf around his neck. In any case, even though the man was reading in shadow, the photograph seemed to be about sunlight. It was everywhere else. On top of another birdcage, which sat on the floor to the right of the reading man, this one onion-shaped and made out of wicker, and sunlight poured through the bars of yet another birdcage, which towered behind the man, a huge rectangular cage filled with birds, birds of all sizes, one of whom, another sunny white dove, perched on a bar and faced a small open window through which streamed more sunlight. Yes, a photograph about sunlight, about a really lovely domestic moment, a man who loves birds, sitting in shadows, his creatures free all around him, basking in the sun, a favorite bird held in his large left hand. But you see, even though I was right in a way, I was also wrong. I hadn't looked closely enough. I had scanned the photograph for the obvious, for what some people call the message, like an undergraduate who reads a book and underlines key passages with a yellow pen. I had not allowed myself to penetrate to the secret heart of the image. Because of the bright birds and the presence of sunlight, I had not looked closely enough into the shadows. For now I saw that the gently reclining man who held the dove in his large left hand was not reading at all. He was drawing. Nor was that a book open on his lap, it was a sketch pad. Even the man's recumbence became clear to me, for that's how you position yourself if you're drawing with one hand and holding a bird with another. What Cartier-Bresson had captured was nothing less than the space in which art takes place, which is also, not so oddly, the moment in which it occurs. Who is the man, I wondered, and I turned to the index only to find out that it was Henri Matisse, the artist, in a photograph taken by Cartier-Bresson in 1944. Yes, Matisse, the artist, of course. I looked again and again at the photograph, at the doves, the sunny room, the man drawing in shadow what he sees in sunlight, clutching a white bird in his wonderful hand. I've been a photographer for over 30 years now, and hearing of Cartier-Bresson's death, I was reminded of that moment when I realized that a camera was just another tool, like a pen or a paintbrush, that could be used to deepen our understanding of what things mean. And I'm sure there are hundreds of us who remember the same thing, turning the page and seeing one of his photographs and saying to ourselves, yes, yes, that's it. That's exactly it. And then spending the next 30 years of our lives trying to find out exactly what the it was.
Writer and photographer John Rosenthal of Chapel Hill.